Hello. On this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles Tony Bennett. The legendary crooner performs at the Mann Centre this evening. Susan Lewis considers this year's Philadelphia Live Arts Festival. And we take a ride on the L in West Philadelphia with artist Stephen Powers to view his love letter, a series of 50 rooftop murals. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
One of the great living links with the heyday of the classic American pop song is back in Philadelphia. Tony Bennett, at age 84, sings at the Mann Center tonight, doing what first made him famous 60 years ago and has kept him in front of audiences ever since, the songs of Gershwin, Arlen, Porter et al. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns met Tony Bennett earlier this week at his Central Park South artist studio, where he spilled a lot of secrets on how he came to be who he is and how he kept from becoming the mid-career fatality that's so common in his world.
Close your eyes. Rest your head on my shoulder and sleep. Close your eyes.
The orchestrations have definitely changed, but Tony Bennett is fundamentally the same talent he was in 1950 when Philadelphia DJ Ed Hurst was one of the first to take a chance on the young Italian-American singer from New York, born Anthony Benedetto, but rechristened Tony Bennett. Though he was occasionally induced to follow passing fashions in his many recordings, Bennett emerged as a fashion unto himself in the late 1980s when he was rediscovered by the American public, appeared on MTV, and sang duets with the much younger Katie Lang. He continues to enjoy a late career sales resurgence. Amid those six decades, Philadelphians have heard some of Bennett's landmark performances, including a 1958 collaboration with Count Basie, in which Bennett was not only among the first singers to cross the color line, but kept doing so, first at the Latin Casino, and then moving on to more august venues.
We really greased up the walls of the Academy of Music that night. And at the end of the concert, it was a lovely spring night. Right next to the Academy of Music is a parking lot. So Basie was there just, you know, smoking a cigarette. And I came over and I just started chatting with him. And some white guy came over to him. He said, "Get my car." And Count Basie said, "I've been parking cars all night. You're going to have to get your own car that quick."
A number of lessons were to be learned that night, both in terms of music and the real world. Bennett became a civil rights activist and something more than a crooner, a true jazz singer. But as much as Tony Bennett talks about the turning points in his life, the seeds of so much that he was to become, both good and bad, were there at the beginning. His support for civil rights began during his service in World War II. His jazz leanings bloomed after the war, when a New York vocal coach, one Mimi Spear, set him straight on who his idols should be.
Mimi Spear was right on 52nd Street, the great jazz street, and told me not to imitate other singers because you'll just be one of the chorus, that you have to imitate musicians, find out how they're phrasing, the trombones, the saxophone, the piano players. So I liked Art Tatum because he was just the most unbelievable piano player and phrased very different. And Stan Getz had this beautiful honey sound. I put those two together, and that's how I got my own style.
Bennett also learned vocal technique dating back to opera's bel canto period.
You know, it takes about 15 to 20 minutes a day. You don't have to belt it out like an opera singer, you know, but you just do the vowels, you know, A-E-R-O-U. And you get to place your voice and just try and get your voice to sound wider. There's a lot of technical stuff, like don't sing way up in the head, you know, sing on the bridge of your nose. It comes out very controlled.
The third lifelong pillar in his career is his taste in music. Bennett spent much of the 1950s battling with Mitch Miller, who controlled artists and repertoire for Columbia Records, and pushed Bennett to record fluffy novelty singles. rather than the full-blown jazz-slanted albums he longed to make. Crossing powerful recording executives is playing with fire, but those instincts were later affirmed by a very different musical personality, Fred Astaire.
He wrote a song called Life is Beautiful, but he used to come over to my home when I lived in Los Angeles, and we'd chat about working on that song. But one of the things he said that changed my life completely, he said, don't make a move without care. He said, you don't know how quick it is to find yourself in an alley and saying, how the heck did we get here? Don't make a move without quality, without caring. And that really stayed with me. I mean, then I really said, okay, from now on, this is my new commitment, that I just will not make a move unless it's just right.
One of Bennett's most artistically acclaimed decisions was a late 1970s collaboration with jazz pianist Bill Evans, in a recording made with just the two of them, no orchestra.
You don't know what love is until you've learned the meaning of the blues.
Bennett is extremely proud of these discs, despite their being made amid the pathetic spectacle of the pianist's heroin addiction.
It was a period in his life where his whole body would swell up and he'd have to lay down after he played a 20-minute set. He would just blow up like a balloon. And here's this very, very handsome man, highly educated, very beautiful family, very distinguished family of people that were very intellectual family. And I told him once, I said, did you ever think of stopping? He said, Tony, I wish that the minute someone stuck a needle in my arm for heroin, I wish someone would have knocked me out so I would have never done it again.
A few years later, Bennett had to confront his own drug dependence, which escalated amid the national disillusionment of America in the 1970s, not to mention his slumping career, his debts with the IRS, and a failing marriage.
When everybody started getting assassinated, from the Kennedys and Martin Luther King, you know, the whole American dream kind of was smashed just like someone throwing a brick in a plate of glass, you know. And as a young man, I started delving into drugs. And I found myself hiding. If I had some marijuana or something like that, or cocaine, I would hide from everybody, you know, and sneak around. And one day I finally realized there was Jack Rawlins, who has managed Woody Allen, who was a friend of mine, and he said that he handled Lenny Bruce years ago. And he made one sentence that changed my life. He said, he sinned against his talent. I dropped everything. And then I realized as I started sobering up, I was able to relax. I felt so much better. I didn't have to sneak around or hide or lie about anything. It's really helped me so much.
A theme that reappears again and again in Bennett's autobiography titled The Good Life is the futility and destructiveness of anger. Bennett quotes Duke Ellington as saying the time he might spend getting angry over a racial slur could be used to write three more hits. And Bennett, for that matter, could probably substitute anger time for one of the many paintings in his Central Park South studio. That's not to suggest that Bennett is whitewashing himself or the crazy recording industry. He simply hasn't become cynical.
It's a con job, you know. I mean, Harry Belafonte, we started out together. So he said to me recently, about 6 months ago, do you remember when they just give us 5 cents a record? You know, but you can't linger on that. It just hurts you. When you're angry, nobody else gets hurt except yourself. The anger affects you physically. You get headaches. You have bad indigestion. You can't sleep at night. You have migraine headaches. You know, you don't have to do that. If you're just alive, you say, hey, life is beautiful.
What an interesting sentiment that is, in a town where the newest fad is t-shirts that say, I'm not angry, I'm from Philly. Imagine life without anger. Tony Bennett does.
Life is beautiful and fine, but darling, only because you're mine.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Tony Bennett performs at the Mann Centre this evening at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Former Pennsylvania ballet dancer Nick Stuccio and choreographer and performer Eric Schoffer founded the Philadelphia Fringe Festival in 1997. Inspired by Edinburgh's world-renowned Fringe Festival, they wanted to create Philadelphia's own eclectic contemporary performing arts festival. Now, as the 2010 Live Arts Festival and Philly Fringe prepares to get underway, WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the core curated component.
A myriad of performing artworks are about to take place in varied locations in and around the city of Philadelphia. They may be collectively known as the Philly Fringe, but producing director Nick Stuccio says from the beginning there were always two distinct components, driven by two different ideas.
One, let's find the best and brightest, those really excellent experimenters, folks who are really breaking the boundaries of their discipline, their fields and forms, and often work very interdisciplinarily, very comfortable with theater, text, and movement, or visual art forms together.
The result of this idea is the Live Arts Festival, which includes people like choreographer Nicole Canuso, who worked with installation artist Lars Jan to create a work called Takes, a 20-foot by 20-foot semi-transparent box, the inside sparsely furnished with things like a chair, a birdcage, and a step stool, is the setting for a dance duet that is simultaneously filmed and projected along the box's walls.
It's at every moment a film, a play, a dance, a poem, and an installation.
Canuso dances with Dito van Reigersberg, who also happens to be a founding artistic director of Pig Iron Theater Company.
I'm primarily an actor, but I also have some movement training, and it's been interesting making this piece because Nicole is primarily a dancer, but she can act as well. So we're both kind of meeting somewhere in the middle.
The simultaneous video projection can zoom in close and gives the audience greater access to the performers, says installation artist Lars Jan.
In dance, there's a certain register of movement that you can pick up from an audience perspective at, 25 feet away or 50 feet away, or depending on the kind of space you're in. Whereas with this piece, there can be this emotional access to their faces and the small moments of exchange that they have between themselves that you usually can't perceive when it's just a live performance.
At any moment, we are being recorded in subtle detail and projected in a large screen. Like our fingertips are performing at 10 foot by 10 foot. At the same time that our live body needs to project far away to the people who are not near us and the parts of our bodies that aren't on camera. Performing for the camera and the audience at the same exact moment is exciting and different.
Over the next several weeks, Philadelphia arts audiences can see in the Live Arts Festival this and 19 other specially selected works of dance, theater, music, and multimedia, including 14 world premieres with about half the artists from Philadelphia and half from places around the world, including New York, Paris, and Cork, Ireland. Aside from the Live Arts Festival, there is also, to be sure, a Fringe, which Nick Stuccio says is an integral part of the total concept.
In an homage to the giant mothership of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, give any artist the chance at getting in front of an audience.
This year, the Fringe includes nearly 200 completely unvetted shows by mostly local artists who produce themselves and plug into the festival calendar.
We help them. We provide a list of sites, of venues, whose owners are interested in hosting Fringe performance. But it's up to the artists to go to those places and make their own arrangements with venues.
For the curated Live Arts Festival, Stuccio travels the world without any preconceived notion of content, looking for a variety of styles to see if any themes emerge.
Large, small, foreign, domestic, experimental, not so experimental. Something interesting always pops out, not with all the work, but four or five or six works might share something. And that is so interesting. It let the artist make the commentary on the culture and society.
This year, a number of works explore the reinterpretation of something classic, or even of the artist's own earlier work. As one example, groundbreaking choreographer Lucinda Child reinterprets her 1979 work, Dance, with new dancers, accompanied by a film version of the original dancers by the late great American conceptual artist Saul LeWitt, and music by Philip Glass. A theatrical piece, The Elevator Repair Service, reinterprets Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. Shakespeare also gets another look.
There's a very irreverent, very funny interpretation of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, and very warm and tender, and actually brings a look at the text in a really interesting way. there's a Beckett piece by a great Irish actor named Conor Lovett, and he's taking a Beckett short story and making it a play.
Venues range from traditional theaters to warehouse spaces that inform the creation of site-specific work. Brian Sanders, performing in 12,000 feet of a 20,000-square-foot room, has expanded his company, Junk, from 5 to 10 dancers.
Otherwise, we would have been just peanuts at the Bolshoi. We're really developing everything around the mechanics of the site, the visual, the sight lines, the cement floor, everything about it has to do with the piece.
Sanders, who describes his work as athletic, semi-theatrical dance, says this piece, set to songs from the 1980s, looks backwards from the future. A monk seeks to create an enlightened sanctuary, using in part elements from the 1380s. A giant trough of water stretches along the length of the performance space.
This is a communal bath of sorts and watering trough that we use.
Do people get wet?
People might get a little wet, yes. We might need a couple of raincoats in the front row. So.
And the dancers?
The dancers definitely get wet, yes.
Next door, in the other half of the warehouse, Nicole Canuso and Dito van Reigersberg dance in their box. The work's title, Takes, is a reference to the idea of multiple takes of a scene for film or dance. Here, that idea is extended to how we live our lives. Some movements are repeated with different consequences.
In our lives, we make a bunch of decisions, and certain decisions get discarded, and the ones that stick become who we are. And so in this project, we really give equal weight to both the edited versions of the moment and the edited versions of our life choices.
Walking to the birdcage, climbing steps, stretching on the floor. A man and a woman move separately, then together. Pedestrian motions flow into dance moves.
My goal is to expand people's idea of what dance can be, because I feel like dance is not just movement. It's the rhythm of an experience. It can be very choreographic. I feel like both the movement and the intention and the sound and the video and the flow of the evening is all very choreographic and intentional.
In this work, the audience can sit, stand, or walk around the box, peering into the action from different angles. During the day, people can sign up for slots to dance themselves, guided by instructions on an iPod. For all the energy a festival creates among the artists, it is the audience who is the final ingredient, an audience that festival organizers say is growing, in numbers and in willingness to experience the creative unknown.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Live Arts Festival and Philly Fringe opens on Friday and runs through September 18th. Next week, we'll look at two successful theatre companies, Pig Iron Theatre Company and New Paradise Laboratories, and their take on the Live Arts Festival. Riders on SEPTA's elevated trains through West Philadelphia are being treated to an unusual public art project painted on rooftops and walls along the Market Street corridor. Love Letter is a series of over 50 murals, each an artistically designed love note. The project is about inspiring and uplifting residents of the surrounding neighborhoods. Your ever after is all I'm after reads the text on the 6100 block of Market Street. At the 5100 block, if you were here, I'd be home by now. Another mural message, prepay is on, let's talk till my minutes are gone. The creator of Love Letter, the nationally renowned artist Stephen Powers, grew up in the neighborhood, and as a teenager was intrigued by the artistic and social possibilities of graffiti. So going to school, this area was part of your commute. You were looking at the rooftops that you ended up painting on. In your previous life as a graffiti writer, did you leave your mark on any parts of West Philadelphia?
As a youth growing up, as a 7th, 8th to 12th grader, I took the train every day and was inspired by, you know, there was literally graffiti going back to the late 60s on these rooftops out here. And I spoke my piece along the rest of them. I climbed up on these rooftops. I painted my name. I tried to contribute something to the general cacophony that was happening out here. And what's important to note is I started writing graffiti as a 16-year-old. And, you know, I had a much more developed worldview about what graffiti was and should be and could be. And I had a passionate thirst at the time to be an artist. So while I didn't make any graffiti that would qualify as art necessarily, I was very mindful of putting it in good places, not really stepping on people's toes so much, and really visually trying to provide as much entertainment as I could for the riding public and the passerby.
And those graffiti years, were they sort of a part of the learning of the artistic, the crafts necessary to become an artist proper?
When I was a youth and wanted to be an artist, I couldn't really connect the dots between my life and the lifestyle of being an artist. I mean, when I was growing up, people used to just shake their heads and feel sorry for me that I would, you know, was determined to be an artist. They felt like, oh, well, you've committed yourself to a life of poverty and penury and possible psychotic episodes, and, you know, good luck with that. And for me, the art exercises I was taking in school were just awfully boring. And graffiti had everything I wanted in the way of art. It had line, it had color, it had design.
And exposure.
Exposure and possible social commentary, if I was so inclined, and I was. And it's important to note, when I started as a 16-year-old in 1984, the Philadelphia Anti-Graffiti Network started, and there was a guy on my TV set that was the director of the Anti-Graffiti Network telling me there was no artistic and no political graffiti in Philadelphia. And I thought, hey, that's a niche. I could do that. So I did.
You divide your career into two phases. There's the graffiti writing phase, and then is there a cutoff point where you say, now I'm an artist? Or what dictated that point where you said, now I'm going to be a proper artist?
Literally, there was a point, I think, in 1998 where I just pulled out the beret and smock and said, I'm going this route for a while. But really, it was a little, slightly more gray area than that. I brought in a lot of the things that I was doing as a graffiti writer. I just stopped writing on people's stuff. I kept the same attitude. I kept the same visual dynamic. And the things that interested me, writing graffiti, continued to interest me as an artist.
With this love letter project, what dictated the individual murals? Was it your voice and indeed the slogans that you were painting? Was it the location? What was the starting point?
The love letter project was determined completely by the locations that we painted the individual phrases. I had maybe five or six sketches of things that I thought would work, and the rest were improvised and made on location, depending on the day and depending on what was to be done. We did a lot of community meetings, something I'd never done before as an artist or as a graffiti writer, to stand in front of a room and, you know,
so
talk
I'm
about.
I'm going to put this in your neighborhood.
Yeah, I'm going to put this in your neighborhood, and I don't look like any of you. And, you know, it's going to reflect everything that you're thinking. And there was a bit of incredulity on the part of the neighborhood that I was going to actually follow through on these promises. But I was genuinely interested in creating work that the neighborhood took ownership of. And they have, because it does reflect a lot of what West Philly brought to me in the way of their concerns and the things that they were interested in and the phrases that were interesting to them and they thought reflected their worldview. And being here and working here 6-9 months and working with the people that we worked, you know, we had an open door policy where the best idea won. And we got some great ones and, you know, we polished up a few and some were totally unadulterated and a lot were old ideas that I had that I just reconfigured to fit what was out here.
The short brushstrokes of this project, when I've been explaining it to people, the easiest way for me to explain it to them was to quote some of the phrases. And the reaction has almost always been, oh, isn't that sweet? Were you aiming for, oh, isn't that sweet, or they're not all sweet?
Not all the phrases are sweet. I was looking for something that was a little bit more bittersweet, that was a little more about the give and take of relationships. I've been in a relationship, committed relationship, for 22 years now. As such, I know it's a give and take. It's an ongoing concern. It's a full-time job, and it never stops. And I wanted to show that, and I wanted to show the multidimensionality of love and how it fills cracks, if you allow it to. And painting these walls, you know,
well,
sweetness.
Literally filled cracks.
Yeah, we literally filled cracks with love and paint, and we really tried to just create something that it has sweet points, it has angry points, it has a lot of places in between. There's melancholy. There are phrases that sound like they could be written by somebody in jail to a loved one. And what the overriding thing that we wanted was, we wanted to be from one person to another, but we wanted to have meaning for everybody. And we also wanted to be from West Philly to West Philly.
They're all short phrases. Did the amount of time that the passengers on the L would have to look at them impact on what phrases went where?
Absolutely. The shortness of time that people have to look at the phrases impacted the length of them. Also, the length of the wall, the heights of the walls. Most of the walls that we painted are typically 10 feet high by 60 feet long. So dimensionally, it favors 2, 3, 4 words at max. So we try to keep it short, and ideally we're trying to reach 17-year-olds. We're trying to reach kids that are on the brink. They're at risk. They're ready to make good or really bad decisions for the rest of their life. So we wanted to be there for them. Like the first community meetings that we had, we heard from a couple kids that were just saying that when they're on the train, they look out the windows just to give themselves something to look at. So if that's the case and that's what they're up against, we wanted to provide something for them, a reaffirming message that maybe not for you, but there is love out there. And if you know it's out there, maybe you could make it for you. So another thing that happened in the course of painting these expressions were some of them we just screwed up. I had guys like painting things that they got the wordage wrong, but the right words were the ones that fit. So
give me an example.
Up on 52nd Street, there's a wall that says, I think I originally wanted to say, this heart is a safe for what's valuable. And it ended up being, this heart is safe for valuables. You know, so it was a bit of editing on the spot that made it better by chopping it down. And the guys were literally like halfway done going like, oh, that's not going to fit. But, you know, this is going to work even better. I learned to let go from the start. So from early on, I let people make their own decisions on their painting, and there's nothing but good results came from that.
Is there any sort of narrative arc to this? If I read them in order, is there an overriding message? Or did you have to be careful that you didn't have too many cute messages or too many angry messages in a row? Or did you curate it in that way?
There's no narrative arc to the love letter. It's more you can jump in at any point in time and get what you need from it. If you only see one of the messages, you get the idea. If you see them all, it's a greater cumulative effect. And we are definitely looking to place phrases in good places where they would resonate the best.
Stephen Powers, his love letter murals are now on view from SEPTA's Market Street L from 46th through 63rd Streets in Philadelphia. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester and performed by Symphony at Sea under its music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's production associate is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter. Thanks for listening.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.